going to talk about our financial literacy this hour and increase our money smarts during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. If you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can even post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
April is National Financial Literacy Month, and you have some information on the benefits to increasing our money smarts. First, Kevin, what exactly is involved with Financial Literacy Month?
It's actually been designated as such by an act of Congress. There are conferences and meetings going on all over the country this month, educational events, and it culminates in Money Smart Week, which is April 22nd through the 29th. And you can find out about events in your area, such as at libraries, different businesses, banks and credit unions offering presentations and educational sessions. Go to moneysmartweek.org, moneysmartweek.org, and we'll post a link to that site at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And do they have like information about On Your Money so people can listen to this?
I think it's kind of subtly implied.
Yes.
That just go back to On Your Money. Listen to all 600 previous episodes.
Well, besides those listeners, regular listeners to On Your Money, how are we doing in terms of increasing our financial literacy?
According to the website Wallet Hub, they did a survey recently, and they published state by state which respondents to the survey were doing better than others in different terms of financial literacy. And Wisconsin ranked 17th overall, but we were number one in what they called wallet literacy. And that was I took the quiz. It was actually pretty difficult. I'll put it up online again later today at onyourmoney.com. But they answered a series of questions about payroll taxes, interest rates, how it affected investments, and Wisconsin residents who took the quiz, we scored higher than any other state in the nation. We are doing more as both a state and as a country, but we're not seeing huge gains, at least by some measures. The Standard & Poor's did a global survey of financial literacy around the world, and they found that only 57% of Americans could be counted upon as being financially literate, and only 17 states in the country require a personal finance class of their students. So the problem here is that because life changes so quickly and people go through different phases so quickly, is what you learn about money when you're 20 or 25 often doesn't apply when you're 50 or 55, and we really have no structure in place to impart that knowledge, and then conditions change. Something that was a good idea to do maybe 10 years ago maybe isn't available today, or it's not the best idea. So it's a constantly evolving environment, and it's kind of like eating right. You know, when you hear one thing today about too much sodium intake, and tomorrow you might read the same study that says no, sodium's not a problem, sugar's the problem. And so it's very difficult for people to get a grasp on some basic concepts that they can use to better their lives.
I'm glad you're putting that quiz online. I was really sweating bullets that you're going to...
I know. It's one of the few things you've had written into our contract. That no more pop quizzes.
No more sneak attacks. Yeah. But they were hard. Those were, they were tricky questions. So, yeah. How does a lack of financial literacy and security affect us?
It can cost thousands of dollars per year in the form of higher interest charges, fees, taxes that you're paying that you didn't know that you didn't have to pay, or there are ways to avoid it. It can also mean lower net returns. There was a study published at Morningstar.com that said people who scored higher on financial literacy exams tended to take a little bit more risk with their investments. And while that can mean bigger losses in the short term, over the long term, it can mean greater gains. And those people actually earned on average 1.3% more on their investments per year than people who didn't score as high on the test. That doesn't sound like much, but again, when you're talking over a 30 or 40 year investment horizon, that can mean hundreds of thousands of dollars. It can also lead to more stress and a lower quality of life. There was a study released by a university in Japan that said that people who have a simple grasp of their finances are far less likely to suffer from anxiety and stress-related illnesses. It's because they don't think about the future as much. They don't worry about it because they feel like, you know what, I've got a good handle on things. I'm doing everything I possibly can, and therefore I don't have to worry about my future as much as I otherwise would have to.
So do you have any financial literacy tips that you can pass along?
Yeah, there's some good news about this. And I've been involved with financial literacy for most of my professional life. I've served on the Governor's Council for Financial Literacy, and I still do a lot of speaking on it. But I will tell you, this is one of those instances where knowing the information is important, but doing taking action with that information is much more important. It's not about knowledge so much as it is about discipline. So if you want some basics, what you can do to help improve your financial situation, first of all, know what you spend every month. Only about 2 of 5 adults have a budget. And then once you know what you spend, you can figure out what can be cut so that you can increase your financial security. And the best way to cut your spending is by increasing your savings, your automatic deductions to your retirement plans at work, or maybe an IRA that you have on your own. And more importantly, know kind of how you're doing. This will take a minute here, but it's one of our most popular features. We always get asked about this on the show, so we'll go over this in honor of Financial Literacy Month. How to know how you're doing financially. And this is about how much money you should be accumulating by each age and stage of your life. And it's a factor of your net monthly spending. What you spend right now minus what you expect to get as a pension or Social Security when you retire. If you're in your 20s, that figure should be 25 times your net monthly spending. So if you're going to need $2,000 a month above and beyond Social Security and pension, in your 20s, you should have about $50,000 set aside. In your 30s, it should be 50 times. In your 40s, it should be 100 times. In your 50s, it should be 200 times that factor. And if you want to know, if you're ready to retire in your 60s, you should hopefully have 300 times your net monthly expenses in savings. Again, if you're spending, let's say, $5,000 a month and you're going to get $2,000 from Social Security, you need to come up with that $3,000 someplace else. And to be really safe and very secure, you need to have 300 times that $3,000 set aside. And if you are investing while you're saving, a very simple portfolio is to keep half of your money in CDs, very safe investments, and half of your money in low-cost, well-diversified index mutual funds, and then rebalance it once every year. And for those of you who are concerned about financial literacy, especially imparting it to your children or your grandchildren, good news, in a couple of weeks during our next membership drive, we are going to offer our On Your Money Mini Money booklet for parents and grandparents. And that's good news because according to Ally Financial, 9 out of 10 parents say they don't talk with their kids about money, and that's part of the problem.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, call 1-800-642-1234. You can also send it via email on yourmoney@wpr.org. You can even post it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's go to Mark in Madison. He has a question. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. My question for you is, when our parents passed away, they left a small sum to fund future family reunion. And we have a reunion about every 3 years. So that means about another 10 reunions, and our generation will kick the bucket. And so what would Kevin recommend would be a good way to invest that to try and enhance its value over the years?
Forgive me, Chuck. You're saying that the parents left the money aside so that they could pay for family reunions in the future?
Yes.
Okay. Aww. Wow, well, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
What a fantastic legacy.
It's been good. We've done 2 already.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You're concerned that the cost of the reunions is higher than what the returns of the invested money is going to provide, and therefore sooner or later it's going to run out, right?
Yes. Well, we expect it to run out, but we'd like to have it last as long as possible.
Okay. Well, there are a couple different ways you can go with this. And it's such a great idea that if you can keep it going from a logistics standpoint, I wouldn't be surprised if, even if you were to run out of money, that other people would start kicking in for it, hopefully. One thing you can do is to set up certificates of deposit. Let's say it's $20,000 and you figured out the cost of the reunion is $2,000 every single year. Is to have CDs that mature every year in the form of $2,000. So you can say, all right, the CD is maturing. Let's use the proceeds for the family reunion. Another way to do it is what I just alluded to in investing for both short-term needs and long-term growth, is to split it 50-50 between a very safe investment like CDs that you can use today that won't go up and down a lot in value. They won't earn very much for you, but they'll be there when you need the money. And then longer-term investments, something like the Vanguard Index Fund, a very low-cost index mutual fund that should give you more potential risk, but it'll also give you more potential return. And finally, you can even look at investments that places like Vanguard, Schwab, Fidelity, many fund providers offer these. They're mutual funds that that start out more aggressive, but gradually grow more conservative over time. They're called target date funds, and you maybe would choose to ladder those out as well, so that each fund is targeted towards a specific decade in the future, or maybe a specific 5-year period in the future. And again, those are called target date funds. They have a broad mix of assets, and then they gradually grow more conservative as the date approaches every single year.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for the call. Here now is a question from a listener via email who says, hi, Kevin. I listen every Tuesday to you. Enjoy. Love the show. So that was a good start. my husband is 66 this year. I'll be 55. We both plan on working as long as we can, mostly because we're very healthy and love to stay busy. We have about $145,000 in debt and have to get rid of it. Our combined income is a little over $93,000. His Social Security at full retirement would be about $1,860, but in 4 years would be about $2,600. That's a big difference. Would it be smarter to collect now while we're still working in order to get out of debt or not? Thank you, Kevin. Isn't it funny how I feel like I know you? And closes by saying you're a funny guy, Kevin.
Well, if you think I am a funny guy, then you definitely know me. Let's start with the Social Security payments. Most recipients have the option of taking their first payment at age 62 for retirement, and they can take it at any time between then and 70, and at 70, they must take it. Now, it rises as a percentage point every year, about 8% or so. For every year that you wait, you get a larger payment. So if you were supposed to get $1,000 at 62, and then you wait another year, you might get $1,080 or so at age 63. But the problem with that, of course, is that when people say, gee, if I wait, I get 8% on my money. No, you don't, because you've given up a year's worth of payments. And so the actual real rate of return on waiting to take Social Security works out to about 3-4% per year. But that, of course, also depends on how long you live. You have to live until age 80 to make waiting make sense. If you think you're going to make it past age 80, waiting makes sense. If you think you're going to pass away before age 80, it's usually best to take it sooner rather than later.
Other than a lower check right now, are there any other downsides to them taking Social Security payments right now?
Yeah, right. If they're working and they have a pretty healthy income, that Social Security is going to be taxed at a pretty high rate. Technically, Social Security in retirement is tax-free, but then there's a formula where you take all of your other income and you add it into half of your Social Security payments, and if that figure exceeds certain thresholds, depending on if you're single or married, then your Social Security benefits can be taxable up to 85%. Now, it's not taxed at 85%. Up to 85% of the benefits can be included as taxable income. And if they're already substantial income, it means that if they take those Social Security payments now, they'll probably be taxed at a 25% federal bracket. And plus, with this couple, and we've run into this before, there's a decent age difference between the couple, and the female in the couple is younger. She's 55 and the husband's 66. So according to actuarial tables, he is going to die much sooner than she will. And if he has the higher check, when he dies, she will get his higher check. So if his check is greater, she's going to get his benefit only, which will then exacerbate the disadvantage of claiming now, because she might live to be, you know, 85 or 90, and then for two or three decades, she's going to get the smaller check.
Yeah. So how should they proceed, do you think?
You know, it depends on what kind of loan they're talking about paying off here. And the question is whether they take it now or later, and it's the cost of interest on that debt versus the smaller check. And then you have to throw the taxes in there as well. So if it's a mortgage, I would say wait to do it because, you know, like I said, the annual return on waiting is about 3 to 4%, and most mortgage rates right now are in that 3 to 4% range. If it's credit card debt, student loan debt that's above 6 to 8%, then I would probably take the Social Security payment and use it to pay that debt off. But if it is, if they do have an advantage for this, the first thing I do before they do any kind of Social Security payments is look to refinance the mortgage and then use any proceeds they can generate to then pay that debt off.
Yeah. If they decide, though, that they want to or need to take Social Security now, any suggestions for ways they can mitigate the lower check and the higher taxes?
They can start by raising their pre-tax retirement plan contributions. If they're working, they might want to put some more money into their IRAs or 401ks or 403bs so that they can still get the money in their name and get access to it. But it can offset the increased income from the Social Security. They'll still net out more money by taking the Social Security and then mitigate and then adding some on to the retirement account contributions for it. That's a good way to cut the taxes for it. And if it is a mortgage that they're paying off, once they pay the mortgage off, they should open up a home equity line of credit so they can still go back in and tap that equity if there's an emergency.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Every time it rains, and it's from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains banners from heaven?
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. We are welcoming your questions for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. John in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin. The reason I'm calling is my credit card company called me this week and said that somebody was trying to take over my credit card, and so they're going to reissue a new card. And I put a fraud alert on with TransUnion. But then yesterday I got a letter from a bank in Maryland that somebody's trying to open a PayPal account in my name, and they rejected it because of identity problems. But I was wondering what it looks like. I might be a victim of identity theft here. I'm not sure what's happening, but I wanted to get Kevin's opinion about that, and also about something like LifeLock or one of these kind of companies that kind of guard your credit.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that, John. Although that's something we're hearing about more and more. So you're in a very large group of victims, and we're all potential victims when it comes to this. The good news is it doesn't sound like they have your Social Security number. Otherwise, it might have been easier for them to open that up. But if they do have your Social Security number, one thing you can and should do is put a freeze on your credit report. And that means that these thieves can't use your information to open up a credit card account. And you do that by going to each credit bureau's website and putting a freeze on it. And that means that you can't open a credit card account or get a loan in your name without unleashing your credit report, if you will, meaning giving the potential lender access to your information, but then nobody else. And it usually means you have a password that protects access to that credit card report. You open it up, the lender gets access to it, sees that you're a good candidate, and then gives you the loan or the new credit card, and then you close it back up again so people can't get access to it. So that's one way to do it. The fraud alert is the other one to do it. In terms of LifeLock, you might want to try it and see what you think about it. You know, it's pretty expensive, and LifeLock does offer a lot of services above and beyond just the freezing of the credit report. They've gotten into some trouble in the past because they've been accused of making bigger promises than what they've been able to deliver on in terms of the safety and the amount of security that involves it. But you might want to try it, especially for this period, and say, I'm in kind of a danger zone here. I'm going to try it for 6 months and see what happens, pay for it, and then cancel it if you decide that it's not worth the extra money. But it is kind of like insurance where, you know, it's a waste of money if you don't need it, and if you do need it, you're very glad you have it.
Yeah, good luck, John. Thanks for the call. Chuck in Reedsburg is with us now. Hi, Chuck.
Hi there. So I've worked in a lot of different jobs over the years, and I've got, you know, retirement money spread all over the place. I got worked for the state for 3 years, worked for another company for about 7 years that had a pension. I've got, you know, rolled over IRA accounts. I got a 401k and about, you know, 48 years old. Can you recommend a some type of an online tool that will let me give me an idea of where I'm at, you know, relative to my retirement goals? Because with so much money all over the place, I have a hard time understanding of, you know, where I'm at relative to where I need to be.
Yeah, are you talking about, you know, your financial security? You just want to see if you have enough money to retire?
Well, yeah, if I'm on track and how much I should be, you know, saving and putting into the 401ks, the IRAs, all that kind of stuff based on these pension plans I've got and the money I've already got in the rollovers and also in the other 401ks. It's just, I've got money in lots of different places. I want a place where I can put all that in and do some kind of a modeling.
Right.
How I'm going to end up when I get to 65.
Right. Well, it depends on how sophisticated you want to get it. You can start out with just online calculators. You can go to a place, there's one called dinkytown.net, which is a suite of calculators that are free. They don't ask for any information for you, and you can just punch in your numbers, and it'll tell you, you know, how much you have and then how much you can expect to get in retirement. You get to put in certain rates of inflation and rates of return, add any savings when you have in there, and that's at dinkytown.net, and we'll put a link up to that website at onyourmoney.com. You can also go to one of the, they're called robo-advisors. These are where they provide little or no human interaction, but the cost is much lower than if you were to actually have an individual person serving as your financial planner or advisor. Wealthfront and Betterment are two of the larger ones out there that you can try, and usually they have calculators that you can just get into and use those before actually having to pay for any kind of services. And then finally, you know, this is what a lot of people do, is they go and they get either a one-time checkup from a financial planner, or they develop a relationship with someone who can help you guide you through this very obviously important part of your life, tell you where you're at. And there are a couple different websites you can go to if you want to look for a CFP, Certified Financial Planner Registrant. You can go to letsmakeaplan.org, and then there's NAPFA, NAPFA.org. They have a search function that you can use to find financial planners. And then the FPA, the Financial Planning Association, also has another one where you can look for different planners in your area, talk with them and say, what can you do for me? What's it going to cost? And then you can decide how to proceed from there. And all these websites, again, we'll put up at onyourmoney.com.
Sounds good. Good luck, Chuck. I love Dinky Town. Do we
know
why?
Yeah, you know why that is? Is it's because it's from the Twin Cities, and there's a very small, tiny little neighborhood in the university area of Minneapolis called Dinky Town.
Uh-huh.
And I think I've used these calculators a lot before, and they're, like I said, they're free to the public. But Dinky Town is the name of the area, and that's what the calculators are called.
That's actually very cute. Just generally, Kevin, I mean, if you, and I'm sure we have a number of listeners who are in the same type of situation as our caller, where you might have this 401k here and this pension there and this other account over here. Is it okay just to leave them all with those other employers, or should you try to consolidate everything under one roof?
Well, there are a couple different advantages to consolidating. One is you may be able to save some expenses because you may get more service for a lower cost if you have a larger dollar balance at a particular provider, like an investment firm or Schwab, Fidelity, Vanguard, a place like that. Another one is that you can eliminate account fees. Some of these accounts might be charging you $50 or $100 a year. If you aggregate them, then maybe the fees will go away completely, or at least you'll only be paying one account fee per year. But there is a danger. If you have a 401k and you're under 55, I would suggest you leave it at least in the 401k form, even if you don't work for the employer anymore. And the reason being is that once you reach 55, you can take money out of your 401k if you've separated from service for that from that employer. You'll pay taxes on the money as you spend it, but you don't pay the 10% penalty. Now, this is possible to do with an IRA as well, but it's much more difficult. There are a lot more hoops you have to jump through. And so if you're going to combine a 401k and other accounts, try to keep the 401ks in the same 401k designation rather than having it all moved into an IRA.
I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And it is time now for Smart Assets. A new study says that barriers to your retirement account can be a good thing, and some employers are taking action. So what's all this about, Kevin?
Well, with most 401ks, as we just talked about, you can't withdraw the money before leaving the job unless you take it under the hardship provisions. And even then, you have to pay taxes on the distribution plus a 10% penalty if you're under 59 and a half. Most 401k participants can borrow money from that plan, but that can hurt you as well because you have to pay the money back, and you usually can't contribute to the retirement while you're paying the loan back. And so there's a phrase called leakage, which some experts are concerned about. They said that due to the leakage we currently have amongst American workers, it could mean a 25% lower income in retirement over the 30 years. And that's a big difference because it means if you don't pull any money out of the retirement plan and just leave it in there until retirement, let's say you're going to get $2,000 a month in income from that, well, a 25% drop is $1,500. And for most retirees, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so if access to retirement accounts is restricted even further, won't people be less likely to contribute to the accounts?
Some people, but others actually appreciate that feature. There was a study conducted by a UCLA behavioral economics professor named Shlomo Benarzi, and they offered participants in a plan two different kinds of accounts, one that said there's no restrictions, and the other one that said, yeah, there are a ton of restrictions. It's very difficult to get your money out of this. And about half of the money actually went into the more restrictive account, even when they changed the variables a little bit and said, okay, we're actually going to pay a little bit more on the less restrictive account and less on the more restrictive account. So not only will you have lower access to your money, but you're going to earn less return. They still found that almost a majority of people put money into the more restrictive account, even when it paid less. And it draws attention to the key attribute for people who are able to manage their money well, and that's self-awareness. Those people who said, I know if I put money in a place where I can get at it quickly, I'll be tempted to take it out and I'll regret it later. So I'm going to put it in money that's harder for me to get at it. Now, the bad news about that is that those people are also more likely to save, so therefore they're less likely to be broke in retirement. So we need to address the needs of both different kinds of people.
So do you have a solution to the dilemma?
I like the current rules just as they are. I don't think that the money needs to be made more restrictive. What I would rather have is individuals act according to their own situation and hopefully have a good knowledge of their own self and how they're going to act. If you have a low income and you're relatively low on money, you're kind of living month to month, which half of Americans and more are, you should save via the Roth IRA because you can pull the contributions out of the Roth IRA at any time, whenever you want, and pay no taxes or penalties on it. That's the contributions. Now, you don't get a tax break on the deposit, but that's okay. You're already in the lower income bracket. You're probably not going to lose much of a tax benefit by putting it into the Roth IRA. And if you know that you can pull it out, you're hopefully going to be able to put more in there because you can get access to it later. But if you have more money and more security and you're in a higher tax bracket, you should use your 401ks and 403bs to the greatest degree you can. And then any money that you have left over, put that into Roth IRAs.
So when should people tap their retirement accounts before they retire?
Well, hopefully it will only be in an emergency and only as a last resort. If you're running into a financial problem and you think that you have to tap your retirement accounts well before retirement, talk to a bank or credit union first and see what kind of terms they can offer for a loan, especially if it's just a short-term problem and you need something to kind of bridge you through until, you know, you get a better job or you get a new job or what have you. Otherwise, uncovered medical expenses. Again, let's say you lose your job and you need to cover your living expenses. If you have high interest debt like credit card debt that is over, say, 15% interest, it's probably a good idea to pull money out of the 401k or IRAs early. Take the penalties, pay the taxes, but pay the debt off. But if you are running through this money and you think you are going to pay it off or the credit cards or whatever, only do it on a month-to-month basis. Sometimes people say, gee, I just lost my job. I'm going to cash out my entire retirement account. I'm going to pay the taxes and penalties because I might need that money in the next few months. Then lo and behold, they get a new job and they've lost maybe half of the money in the retirement account due to taxes and penalties, and it turns out they didn't need all of it. So just try to only use a certain portion of that month to month to get you through the crisis.
Is there a better strategy? Do you have a preferred strategy for tapping the retirement accounts?
Right. Depending on, you know, your problem at hand and the type of accounts you have, start with those Roth IRA contributions first. And then if you have a 401k that you can borrow from, go to that as well. And as we just discussed, if you have a 401k and you're over 55, then pull that money out in and of itself. Take your IRAs out. If you can avoid the 10% penalty, there are some things we'll talk about next week that you can get access to retirement accounts before 59.5 and not pay the 10% penalty. After that, take the money out of the IRAs even after you take the, even if you have to pay the 10% penalty. And finally, deplete the rest of the Roth IRAs after that.
I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Paul in La Crosse is with us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kevin. I have a question for you wondering what you know about the rules of stock mergers. I had my broker actually sold stock A because of a merger with stock B, and then they bought back the combined company in stock AB. And the IRS sent me a letter saying I now owe $3,000 because of a taxable event for selling a stock that I didn't initiate. What do you know about that, Kevin?
When you talk about a sale, Paul, was it actually something where the broker put in an order to sell it, or was it a case of where it was a cash purchase of the company and you really had no choice?
Apparently, I had no choice because I wasn't told about it.
What do you mean? Who was supposed to tell you about it? Who didn't?
It was with a broker, and this occurred 2 years ago. And I got the letter in the mail today saying I owed the money. And when I called them, they just said that was standard procedure in terms of mergers, where that's what they do. They sell one and then buy it all. All the money goes back to the second merged company.
Okay, that may have happened. What I'm guessing happened is instead it was a cash buyout where the first company bought, or the, excuse me, the one, the acquiring company bought the stock that you had, gave you cash for it, then that was a taxable transaction. Mergers have different ways of being taxed. Sometimes they can be not taxed at all, but other times they are. So I don't think you actually sold the stock, but I think you said you now have shares in the new company, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I'm guessing what happened is that due to the way that the merger was structured, it was a taxable event to the shareholders, and therefore the bad news is you probably do owe the capital gains taxes on that. The good news is you have a new higher cost basis on your new shares that you still own, correct? You haven't sold those yet?
No, I haven't sold them.
Okay. Check with those, Paul, and see if, you know, if those have actually gone down in value, you may be able to sell those. If it's below your cost basis, you may be able to take a loss on it and use that loss to offset your income taxes or any other capital gains taxes. But based on what you've told me, it sounds like, I'm sorry, the good news is you're paying capital gains taxes because you have a capital gain, but the bad news is you probably owe the taxes.
Thanks, Paul. Good luck to you. If you have a question for Kevin McKinley, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Come fly with me. Let's fly. Let's fly away.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. So are you afraid to fly? Passengers getting bumped from flights have been in the news recently, to say the least. There are some things that you should know before flying the friendly or not-so-friendly skies. So give us the scoop, Kevin.
Well, United Airlines has had a few tough days here in the last couple weeks. First of all, they bumped a man off a flight, unwillingly so, and really bumped him. And, of course, it was caught on video, which went viral, and it was really a disturbing video. Then a couple on their honeymoon was bumped off so that some United employees could take their seat over at a discounted rate. A scorpion dropped off out of the luggage compartment and bit a passenger. And this was all started a few weeks ago when they actually knocked a couple teenage girls off of a flight because they were wearing stretch pants or yoga pants. And so they've really been under a dark cloud, literally and figuratively lately. The CEO was forced to make some comments about the gentleman being dragged off of the plane, and it took him three times before he finally said the right thing. And so United has put new rules in, but that's not before the stock dropped precipitously. They lost about $250 million the day that the video of the guy being dragged off the plane came out. And in total, they lost about $750 million in 1 week, and then of course lost more in their public relations because people like me are talking about it and on broadcast media. So United has changed their policies to making it more restrictive for employees being able to bump civilians off of the flight, and other airlines are obviously reviewing their policies and raising compensation limits for passengers who do get bumped.
Oh my gosh. I had not heard about the scorpion.
I don't think, you know, United actually placed it there, but still, it was an unfortunate incident.
All right. So what do we need to know about the potential of getting bumped?
It's not very likely. In 2015, about 1 out of 1,200 flyers were bumped, and even then, 9 out of 10 of those actually volunteered for it. So it's only going to happen about once every 6 to 8 flights, and most of the people who do get bumped actually take advantage of it. But some airlines are more likely to bump than others. According to the DOT, between 2013 and 2016, among the big airlines, the ones who bumped passengers less often were Alaska and American, and those who did it more often were Delta and United.
Yeah, so what rights do flyers have if they are getting bumped?
Legally, it depends on how long you will be delayed. If it's less than an hour, nothing. You're not entitled to any compensation whatsoever. If it's an hour or so, you're going to get about 200% of a one-way fare up to $675. 2 hours or more, are entitled up to 400% of the one-way fare up to $1,350. But again, many of these airlines may offer more money for it if you do get bumped or if you're willing to leave the flight. United has now authorized their personnel to give up to $10,000. Delta has said the same, but you have to volunteer to leave to get the best perks.
So is there any way we can avoid getting bumped?
Try to book emptier flights. When you are booking, you can go online and pick your seat, which is a good idea to do anyway. But then try to pick a plane that is obviously not crowded. Once you do buy your ticket, check in the moment you can check in. That's usually 24 hours before the departure time. So the minute you check in, that makes it less likely that you'll get bumped. If you have elite status at a specific airline or you've paid for a more expensive ticket, you're flying business or first class, you're less likely to get bumped. And most of these airlines have policies where they will not bump people who have a disability, they won't break up families, and they won't bump minors who are flying by themselves.
What if you would like to get bumped?
As a living, as a career? What do you do for a living? Oh, I just book tickets and then I hope they kick me off. But the opposite is true. Try to book flights that are already full and then still check in online right away, but check on in early. And then as the plane fills up, you'll start to see that there aren't any seats left for it. Once you get to the airport and at the gate, talk to the agent and said, hey, is this a pretty full flight? If they say, yes, it is, say, well, if you need to bump somebody, just say, check with me. Don't offer any dollar amount or anything. Just say, check with me, and then sit by the gate. Don't go get Starbucks or a Cinnabon or anything. You have to sit right there so that when they call volunteers to be bumped, that you're the first one who can jump on the offer. And if you do get bumped, make sure you ask for cash, not the vouchers, because the vouchers usually expire within a year after they're issued, and they are often subject to restrictions in terms of when you can use them.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there's still time for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email a question on your money at WPR.org. Back to the phones. Kelly in Oshkosh is with us. Hello, Kelly.
Good morning. Hi, Kevin. I have a question about a car loan. I've not had a car payment for years and years and years and years, but I'm buying a new car. And I'm wondering, in general, is it better to go with what the dealer might offer as far as financing, or should I go through my credit union?
Both. I would actually don't get two loans. I mean, just get the one loan. That would be fraud if you got two loans for one vehicle. What kind of vehicle are you buying, if you don't mind me asking?
We're buying a Honda, some kind of Honda.
Either it's a good idea to know which kind of Honda before you actually buy it. Don't just
maybe.
That's an excellent choice. Yes. I know a lot of people who have those Honda CRVs. Great value. You still get? Are you getting in the all-wheel drive or two-wheel drive?
All-wheel drive.
Good
maybe
for
HRV.
You.
Depends. I drive a Civic now, and the CRV is kind of big for me. I kind of like the HRV, but it might not be big enough. We're hauling grandkids around.
Okay. Good. Go to the credit union and say, okay, all right, if I get this loan, what terms will you give me? And then go back to the dealership and see if the terms the dealership can offer on the financing are better than what's offered at the credit union. And then check with the dealer and say, if I don't get my financing through you, is there a cash back option? Meaning if I don't take the, let's say, 1.9% financing over 5 years, do you then get me a discount off of the negotiated price, like say $1,000 off the price?
Okay.
And then add up the difference in the interest cost between the two and the dollar amount, and that should tell you which one is the best one to do. But many times these dealers, they don't offer anything above and beyond just the special rate financing. So compare the two, but I'd go to both places. If you do the application for the loan within a narrow window of about maybe a week to 2 weeks, it won't affect your credit rating, and it won't affect it very much anyway, but especially if you're applying for multiple loans in a short period of time. So go to the credit union, see what they say, and then take those numbers back to the dealer, and I think it's an excellent choice.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Kelly. My husband loved his CRV. We had it forever and ever. Mike in Hartford is with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I am 66 years old. I work full-time as a truck driver, and I have tremendous tax deductions because of my job. I probably take back about $3,000 to $4,000 a year in tax returns. I want to draw the money out of my 401k, pay the taxes on it while I'm working, so that I don't have to pay the taxes on it when I'm retiring. Is that a good idea, bad idea? How should I do that?
The only reason, Mike, that you're interested in doing this is because you think that you just want to get the taxes behind you?
Yes.
Okay. I would not do that unless there's some mitigating circumstances, extenuating circumstances that dictate that you are going to be in a higher tax bracket when you retire. It's usually best to delay it as long as you possibly can, because most people when they retire are in the same or a lower tax bracket, and therefore they pay less in taxes by taking it in retirement versus taking it now and paying the taxes and being done with it. If you are going to pull it out, though, Mike, what I would have you do with it is at least convert the amount to a Roth IRA. And so you can pull it out, pay taxes on it, then put it into a Roth IRA. And then once it's in the Roth IRA, you can basically pull the contributions back out whenever you want. The earnings, though, are sheltered from taxation, and there's no mandatory distribution at 70 and a half. And as of today, in today's laws, distributions from Roth IRAs do not affect your Social Security payments, the taxation of it. Every other form of income, including tax-free bond income, is added into that formula that determines whether or not your Social Security is taxable. But Roth IRA distributions, again, as of now, do not. So I wouldn't do it, but if you are going to do it, at least move the converted amount into a Roth IRA for the time being.
Okay, well, that was my plan to do, is put it somewhere, you know, like my wife has a Roth of her own. But, of course, mm-hmm. I can't put it in there because then we can't get it out because she's 51 years old and I'm 66, so I'm... You know, I don't want to put it in her account.
Plus, it's illegal to do that. You have to open up your own Roth IRA. You can't put your money into somebody else's Roth IRA. It's very generous of you, but but you can't do that.
Mike, good luck to you. Alex in Fitchburg is with us now. Hello, Alex.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on. See, I listen every week, and I take some great advice from you guys, and I'm in a good place myself, but I have an immediate family member, my stepmother, in fact, who is not doing so well. She has a lot of financial trouble, and I want to help her out. And I'm wondering, Kevin, if you have any tactful, respectful ways that I can help her and her situation.
Good for you, Alex, and especially for your stepmother. This is not, you did not spring from her loins, and so you don't have any obligation in that sense, but you just have a, sounds like a moral and familial obligation to still do it, so good for you. Is it something where this is temporary, or is she just in such a hole and of an age where there's really no way out of her issues?
That I'm not super familiar with. I know it's been kind of a slow decline for her. She had her car repossessed a couple months ago, and now she's going through an eviction. So I just I'm not in a financial place myself where I can give her money, but
right.
I would like to, you know, do whatever else I can.
Yeah. How old is she?
She is just turned 50.
Okay. How old are you?
I'm 27.
Okay, good for you, Alex. Here's what I would do. I would say, you know what, negotiating this stuff is really difficult, and especially if you're the person who is subject to these, you know, the eviction and the repossessions and all that, and say, can I just serve as an advocate for you? Can I help you sort out this stuff? Can I help you negotiate with these people, look at the letters they're sending, look at what options you have, and help you do this? Because I really care about you, and you can look upon this in the same sense as almost like a healthcare crisis. It's of if she were suffering, you know, going through cancer treatment or something, you being the loving, caring person you are, you'd say, yeah, I'll drive you to the doctor. I'll sit there in the appointment. I'll make sure that if you need ice chips in a cup, I'll get that for you. And I'm willing to do the same thing for you financially. And if she says, nope, I've got it, don't worry about it, then say, great, I offered. And say, if you change your mind, just let me know. I'm happy to help you. There's no judging. I just want you to be in the best possible situation you can be. So please let me know in the future if I can help you. And a lot of times, Alex, that kind of help, helping her negotiate this awful situation, can be at least as valuable as giving her money, because there are resources and options for her out there. But she obviously hasn't been able to avail herself of them.
Thank you, Alex. You're very kind. Time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we're talking about issues that you have in the air. Go to flyersrights.org, 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 and set up a link to this in your phone, because this not only has all of the information that you need to contact any airline in a problem, but there's even a special feature called Help I'm Stranded that says if you're stuck someplace or you're stuck on a flight and you can't get off, that tells you what to do to get the recourse that you need. Flyersrights.org, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. On Your Money can be heard live Tuesday mornings at 8. It is rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.